This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. Late last week, the North Carolina General Assembly wrapped up its work for the summer, but not before passing a $23 billion budget dealing with the controversial HB 2 legislation while continuing its ongoing feud with the governor and announcing a return to the state capitol with at least two short sessions this fall. We look at the major legislative enactments so far, what might be coming in the fall, and the continuing political divide in state government with three observers of the state's politics. In Raleigh, Colin Campbell, who is taking over the editorship of the NC Insider and is a legislative reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, joins us. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good, good. Also from Raleigh is Tim Boyum, host of Capital Tonight on Spectrum News, a daily show recapping the state's politics. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And joining us in studio is WFAE's Tom Bullock, who covers politics, money and influence, and elections. Good morning, Tom.
Always a pleasure to be here.
If you want to join the conversation or have a question for one of our panelists on the workings of the General Assembly so far this year, send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org, find us on Twitter, or you can join us via our Facebook live stream. Before we dive into the major actions of the legislature this year, I want to get each of your perspectives on what has happened over the past 6 months in this year's so-called long session so far in the General Assembly. Colin, we'll start with you. What have been the highlights for you as you've been watching the legislature in action?
You know, it's been somewhat of a dull long session in some ways. There haven't been any sort of big signature initiatives that have come out of this year's session as we've seen in past years earlier in the Republican control of our state legislature. Certainly the first few months were dominated by House Bill 2's discussions. There was a lot of sort of backroom intrigue of will they repeal it, will they not repeal it, what will the replacement look like, and that finally came to fruition back in March. And then once that replacement bill came out, as controversial as it was, we haven't heard as much about it since that time. Certainly there's been the discussion around the budget with teacher raises, how big should they be, income tax cuts, pretty good partisan divide there on whether or not to add additional income tax cut this year. But other than that, it's been a lot of really minor stuff over the course of this session, and I think that just sort of speaks to the fact that a lot of the signature policy initiatives that the Republicans had have been enacted in earlier sessions, and now it's a lot of little stuff to deal with at this point.
Tim, how have you seen the session so far?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it was sort of a tale of two sessions. It was hurry up and wait for the first couple of months as we knew they were working on an HB2 repeal behind the scenes. And so it was really slow. There was not talk about legislation. There was not a lot of committee meetings. There wasn't a lot of budget discussions. And then, bam, that deal made its way through. And then it was like a mad dash to the budget. And we saw, you know, the releases from the separate chambers, and the budget became the real focus. So really, to me, the two highlights, I guess, were the HB2 repeal and the budget. And Colin's right, there weren't a lot of massive signature items. And I'm a little surprised by that because we don't know what's going to happen in 2018 with the elections. First of all, with an election occurring, and then what might happen after the elections. So I kind of thought there might be some larger legislative moves made. But don't forget, we have two upcoming special sessions in August and September, and that may, you know, stay tuned.
always fun and intrigue. Tom, how have you seen the legislative session?
Well, I agree in part with what Colin and Tim said, but I've got a slightly separate take on a signature event. It really is a tale of two sessions, and the way Tim laid it out is exactly right. Dealing with House Bill 2, contrary to all the public face that Republican leaders in the General Assembly put out, everybody knew they were trying to get it off the books, to find some kind of compromise. Mm-hmm. And that took out a huge amount of oxygen from the room for the first part of the session. And then, of course, we do have the budget and the mad rush for that. I do, however, differ with my colleagues a bit, because I think if there was basically a signature move here this session, it's the judiciary. And it's remaking North Carolina's judiciary in what could easily be called a far more partisan way. I mean, we have Representative Justin Burr, who's coming out, and this really started with one of the many special sessions, you know, last December. Mm-hmm. You see the return to partisan elections for judges. You see the shrinking of the Court of Appeals from 15 to 12. You know, towards the tail end, we saw this continue with this idea of redrawing all the judicial legislative or the judicial election districts. And I think that was a signature moment. I think that the ramifications are pretty – I mean, we can go more in depth if you want to later, but I really think that it was – you know, the ramifications of that action is pretty significant for the state, and we could be feeling it for a while.
Okay. We will certainly get into the courts and the role of the courts. They've seemed to have been fairly active just simply because it seems like maybe every other week one branch, either the legislature or the executive, was suing the other in terms of some kind of action that they took. The divide between the two, between particularly Governor Roy Cooper and the legislature. Tim, is it playing out as we kind of foresaw it even before Cooper had taken office with the kind of acrimony and maybe partisan retribution between the two branches of government?
Yeah, at the end of the day, I think we're where we thought we would be. But getting there has been, frankly, to me, very interesting. You know, we spent most of November and December trying to figure out how Roy Cooper was going to tackle this strategically. And to me, it was fascinating. You know, a lot of people who have known Roy Cooper through the years, he's a pragmatic, thoughtful legislator in the past, he's attorney general. He likes to work, to compromise, to get the best thing done. But we're in a different era now. And when he made hires like Ken Udy as a senior staff member and as Sadie Weiner as his communications director, you know, they have fairly big political backgrounds. Sadie Weiner in particular, she used to be up in Washington and she ran communications for Kay Hagan's campaign. And so to me, that was the first signal that, okay, he's going to fight back quite a bit. And we've seen nothing but that. I mean, it really blew up, you know, with the special sessions last December. And then, of course, with the HB2 discussions, we've seen dueling news conferences. And so I've actually had conversations with some people that know him closely and many members of his campaign staff and his gubernatorial staff. And it's been interesting to talk to them about whether this is really Roy Cooper speaking or if it's people, you know, behind the scenes, because some of the terms like short-minded, the most reckless budget, to me, those aren't terms we'd always would have seen Roy Cooper talk about in the past in that kind of way. Although they argue he's pretty mad about what's been going on. And so that is him, you know, talking in sort of that way. So I think we got to where we thought we would be. It's just been interesting to watch the progression.
Colin, at the beginning of the legislative session, there was a lot of maybe bluster by the state Senate wanting to confirm cabinet appointments by the governor. And this seemed to be a new day and a new approach that the state Senate was taking with a member of the opposition branch in the governor's mansion. Did it really amount to anything, or was it just a lot of fireworks in terms of those cabinet appointments?
Yeah, that was a thing that really kind of fizzled out. It seemed like it was going to be some pretty interesting fireworks at the beginning of the session. Roy Cooper was suing to stop this process from going forward, saying it was sort of an unconstitutional issue with separation of powers for him to have to put his cabinet nominees through this process. And for a while, there was this period of time where Larry Hall, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, was supposed to show up, and they had a table and a microphone ready for him, and he didn't come because he was awaiting a court order. And then when they're courts finally decided and ultimately found that, at least for now, the cabinet confirmation hearings could go ahead. These things went by very quickly. There was almost no votes against the Democrats' nominees by Republicans. And by the time we got to the last two extremely exciting positions of Secretary of Revenue and Secretary of Information Technology last month, you know, no one really even showed up to the meetings to watch because they expected that it would be done in 10 minutes and there wouldn't be much excitement there. So as far as a Washington-style Senate confirmation process, we've not gotten that at all out of this new law.
And it seems like at times that the courts have become kind of the referees between the two branches. Tom, the lawsuit over the State Elections Board and the Ethics Commission, is that still ongoing? Do you know where that potentially stands?
Well, I'm not sure if there's any more motions that are going to come through that. But as it stands right now, it's been given the thumbs up, I believe, to proceed and merge these two boards. And it'd be interesting to see exactly how that all works out, because now you have, just to remind our listeners, before you had the North Carolina State Board of Elections, which was obviously charged with running and making sure elections are free and fair. And then you had an ethics commission, which was in charge of investigating, you know, potential ethics violations on the part of politicians and lawmakers. So you're merging these boards together. The more interesting thing was not just the merger. It was the fact that under the law that was passed, it limits who gets to appoint for the first span of time. So it basically locks out Roy Cooper, the governor, from being able to appoint for, I believe it's 6 months, which is actually, you know, more important than it sounds, because a number of these positions are about to get appointed by the General Assembly. And the law also stipulates that if a position is appointed by the General Assembly, only the General Assembly gets to appoint its, you know, that person's successor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think overall it was, again, a lot of bluster. I think, you know, depending on how these boards work, they can still work just fine. But one of the early criticisms was the idea that the lawmakers would be in charge of appointing the people who are there to keep watch on them, which could sound like a conflict of interest. But in the past, frankly, it's actually worked out all right.
Right, right. The major activity of any legislature is to pass a state budget, which the Republicans did with a $23 billion plan. Out of this 1,000-page document, who were the winners and losers? And I'll start with you, Tom, about what's your perspective on the state budget?
I think winners and losers are defined by party in this kind of sense. I'm not sure it's so easy to lay out winners or losers. Take out what is the perennial issue with budgets in North Carolina, teacher pay. Mm-hmm. Teachers got a pay increase that averages over the 2-year biennium. Well, I think it's like
9.6%.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that is a significant pay increase. You could put them in the winners bracket, except that the governor and Democrats were calling for more. So do you still define them as winners or not? I think if you are going to find some clear losers, you can find it in what is becoming a real trend. I mean, we're used to seeing this with the state Senate, this insertion of policy into budgets. But I would argue that this year we saw that from the House, the North Carolina House of Representatives, far more than we have in the past. And it was fascinating to see some of these kind of policy points that were put in there. I mean, things like this big push to raise the age, where we would stop being the last state. And now this is law. So this has happened. North Carolina was the last state to try 16 and 17-year-olds as right. adults. Rather than passing that as a standalone bill, it was included in the budget, which is odd. Not unheard of by any stretch, but it was odd. And then you also had – at least to me, and Tim and Colin have covered politics here longer than I have, but to me, what was fascinating too were the writers, you know, the earmarks that were added in to the budget, the spending on things that were not included in either the Senate or the House budget, but suddenly emerged after the two, you know, bodies got together to work out a compromise. And my favorite one to point out, which I do think is eye-catching, goes along with raise the age, which was the budget mandates that a new $13.5 million juvenile facility be built in North Carolina because of these new rules. However, there's a writer in there that says that the only place this facility can be built in the entire state is in Rockingham County. And Rockingham which happens to be the home of Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger. He is, you know, said he didn't ask for this, but defended it, saying it's centrally located. So therefore, hey, you know, it's a great place to have it. It's still eye-catching, to say the least. And that's that writer that it has to be built in one specific county. That's not normal, at least in my experience.
Right. In the other parts of the budget that we'll get to in just a moment, taxpayers get a tax cut. Looks like the personal income tax goes from 5.499% to 5.25%, raises the standard deduction to $20,000 for married couples filing jointly from $17,500, and also lowers the corporate income tax rate to 2.5% from 3%. We'll pick up on that discussion about the state budget after this break. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hefner Financial of Charlotte. Jim Hefner is an independent fiduciary financial planner whose team specializes in retirement solutions and tax strategies. Information at youlljustknow.com. And Charlotte Douglas International Airport, reminding travelers to plan ahead when flying this summer. Real-time airport parking information and travel tips are available at cltairport.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, the Mecklenburg County Health Department has been under scrutiny since it was revealed in February that the agency failed to timely notify nearly 200 women about abnormal pap smear results. Outgoing Health Department Director Marcus Plescia has maintained that despite that lapse, patients were receiving quality care. However, details from an internal review indicate that may not have been the case. We'll look at where the department goes from here, and we'll meet an obituary writer for the New York Times featured in the new documentary, Obit. That's when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we look ahead to this week's G20 summit in Germany, global trade, climate change, security, and maybe the future of the West, all there. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're discussing the legislative business just completed by the North Carolina General Assembly with Tom Bullock of WFAE News, Tim Boyum of Spectrum News, and Colin Campbell of the Raleigh News and Observer. You can join in our conversation by sending us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org, send us a tweet to Charlotte Talks, or join us on our Facebook live stream. We were talking about the $23 billion budget, and Tom had mentioned about the surprise in the number of riders that was attached to the spending bill. Colin, is this something that we typically tend to see, or is this maybe a new approach by the Republicans in the General Assembly?
I've been tracking the use of earmarks or pork spending, or however you might term it, in the budget for the last couple of years, and there have always been a few projects that are added typically in the districts of leadership or key budget writers. This year is really a new level. I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars that are going to specific lawmakers' districts and for a variety of projects for specific nonprofits, for downtown revitalization projects, sometimes in towns that aren't even towns. There are a couple of unincorporated communities that when I looked them up on a map, there's just a Dollar General store in the middle of town, and there's nothing that you could describe as a downtown, but they'll be getting state money for downtown revitalization projects. So this is definitely a new level. I think some of it stems out of the fact that we are going into a legislative redistricting process in the next few months. And a lot of the Republican leaders are trying to shore up the support in their own districts. So if they end up with a slightly more competitive race than they would have otherwise, they're going to be in good shape. I was actually just in Cleveland County passing through over the holiday weekend, which is House Speaker Tim Moore's hometown, and the banner headline for the budget in the Kings Mountain newspaper was $9 million in county projects funded in state budget. So certainly they're trying to spin this as, you know, we've brought home the bacon for our communities.
Gotcha. In describing the budget bill as being short-sighted and small-minded, Governor Cooper vetoed the particular budget bill. Tim, what was his major objections in the spending package?
I mean, he wants bigger teacher pay increases, and he believes that these tax cuts are going to put a big hole in the budget in the future and that they're overwhelmingly going to help the rich more than the poor middle class in North Carolina. That's sort of the lens that the governor and the Democrats are seeing this through. I just want to go back real quick 1 second on the pork spending, as it is often called. The Republicans will point out, and correctly, that this is by far nothing new, that this happened immensely when Democrats were in charge as well. In fact, every time I have this discussion with someone, it gets brought up about former Senate President Pro Tem Mark Bassnight and the Jeanette Pier out on the Outer Banks. So that is nothing new. It's same up in Washington. The difference is that Republicans typically want to limit government spending. And so that's sort of where this contradiction comes in of sorts when we see this. But back to your question, yeah, I mean, it's not enough investment in education and in, you know, the policies of North Carolina, and it's tax cuts for the rich and not enough for teachers. That's really sort of the crux of the governor's argument. I think, again, what I was talking about earlier, I think some people are surprised by sort of the depth of the argument. In fact, Charlie Jeter, who's from Mecklenburg County, who was a former lawmaker, told me on Capitol Tonight that he's voted for more fiscally irresponsible budgets when he was in the legislature. So to hear that from a Republican is kind of interesting.
Interesting. And it wasn't just, I mean, the governor's office, I believe, did get a budget cut to his operations, but it wasn't just the governor. It seemed like the legislature went after several other Democrats in the Council of State, most notably the Attorney General's office, had his department's budget cut. He claimed that it would affect about 100 positions within his department. Was this a political retribution or some kind of a partisan attack by the Republicans on the Democratic Attorney General, Tom?
I mean, I fall back on the words of Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger. When he was questioned about the cuts, he said, you know, we don't think that the Attorney General is representing his client, is doing his job correctly. And his client, in many ways, is the lawmakers of North Carolina, and therefore we're cutting his budget. I'll let that stand in terms of political retribution or not. But let's not forget that this also comes after the Attorney General did not try to defend North Carolina's voter law. In fact, wrote an amicus brief against it. Josh Stein is a controversial figure for Republicans in the General Assembly. He just left there. You know, he was a member of the General Assembly. And it's not just – what was interesting to me is the way they targeted these cuts. I mean, overall – and my numbers here are kind of back of the napkin. But overall, the Department of Justice, North Carolina Department of Justice, has a budget of about $80 million. So when you're talking about, you know, the money that they're talking about cutting, it doesn't sound – huge.
Yeah.
In fact, Republicans have argued it's about 10%. Other people have seen, other departments have seen similar cuts.
Right.
And they're right, except that these cuts are so targeted that they deal specifically with staff, human resources, IT, and lawyers. And Attorney General Stein has said it could lead to as many as 123 people to be laid off, and that many of them are the lawyers who deal with the most complicated cases and represent North Carolina directly in court. What surprises me the most about this, honestly, Dr. Bitzer, is the fact that when Governor Cooper kind of laid out this olive branch on the budget, he vetoed it and said, look, you know, if you do the following things, I will sign the budget. Restoring funding for these positions was not one of his negotiating points. He said, hold back on the corporate tax cuts. Let's get more money to teachers. He did not ever push on this. So
even though he was Attorney General before he became governor.
Exactly. And okay. So, I'm curious to see how these cuts actually what happens. I mean, that's the story I know we're going to be following because it could be significant. It could, again, be bluster. But the fact that you are targeting the lawyers in this budget for the Attorney General, it could cause problems.
Yeah, it wasn't just the governor and the Attorney General. This session also saw history being made when a state representative took the first steps to impeaching the Secretary of State, Elaine Marshall. This would be the first impeachment of an executive branch officer since Governor William Holden was impeached, convicted, and removed from office in 1872. And the most recent impeachment was in 1901 against members of the state Supreme Court who remained on the court after being charged. Colin, what are the grounds for this impeachment, and could this be considered in the fall upcoming sessions?
Yeah, this is one stemmed a couple months back when State Representative Chris Millis, who is from Pender County, one of the most conservative Republican members of the House, brought up this issue that he believed that Elaine Marshall, the Secretary of State, who is responsible for issuing notary public licenses, had been allowing non-citizens to become notaries. Now, her department counters that there's been some court rulings that's determined that you can't use citizenship status as a basis for whether you issue the notary permits or not, but Millis believes that she's violating her oath of office by having this policy and issuing these notary licenses. So he called on her in a press conference to resign and called for an investigation several months back. And then we didn't hear anything more about it for a while. And then suddenly on the very last week of session, we see this resolution that would start an impeachment process for Secretary of State Marshall, which, as you mentioned, is the first time in well over 100 years since this has been pursued in North Carolina, at least successfully. And that went through the House Rules Committee with a party line vote to sort of keep the process moving forward. The House opted not to take any further action this session. Representative Millis told us he didn't see the support and didn't have enough material, I guess, to go on so far, so he didn't push it to a House floor vote just yet. But the resolution that creates these extra sessions in August and September specifically list impeachment matters as one of the topics that can be considered. So I don't think this issue is dead. There's been talk of a special prosecutor. I think we are going to be hearing more about this as we go towards the end of the year.
Tim, how has the Secretary of State responded to Elaine Marshall? How has she responded to these charges?
She has vehemently denied that she's done anything wrong.
What's that issue?
She doesn't believe that. I mean, as Colin said, she believes she's following the law and guidelines in previous court cases. This was an issue back in the 2016 campaign. In fact, I did an in-studio debate with Elaine Marshall, Michael Poglia, and he raised this during the debate. It was late last September, I believe, that we did the debate. And she was furious when this went through. And, some people are saying it's politics. It's going to be a challenge for them to tackle this, I think, because there is so little history with this. Although Representative Millis says that staff has been researching the 1870 case for possible moving forward with this. But it is so unprecedented. I think some people are surprised that it's, you know, being used in a case like this. But, you know, I think Representative Millis thinks perhaps, you know, laws were broken doing this. But boy, this would be a big step if they move forward with this.
In a recent New York Times profile about the state that asked, is North Carolina the future of American politics? Carter Wren, who's a veteran North Carolina Republican political consultant, was quoted as saying the state is, quote, more polarized and more acrimonious than I've ever seen. And I've seen some pretty acrimonious politics, he hastened to add. I worked for Jesse Helms. I mean, is the past 6 months, Tom, what we're going to expect over the next 3.5 years in terms of Democrats in the executive branch and Republicans in the legislative branch basically at war with each other?
Well, if it is a direct war, Dr. Bitzer, I would say it's more of a cold war. But yes, I mean, honestly, I see no relinquishing of stances from either side. And it's important to note, like, North Carolina is a great microcosm of explaining this, but this is a trend that we are seeing nationwide, right? You still see the classic fights, not just between Republican and Democrat, but urban versus rural. There's still this kind of idea behind North Carolina politics of if say, the cities are getting something – I'm not, and so I should be getting something more too. What you're seeing is basically, to paraphrase what Tim said earlier, it's a tale of two tales of the same state, I guess. You know, it's unfortunately politics. We are self-selecting into our own echo chambers, right? We're living with other people who are living around other people who tend to have the same views that we have. And then the only kind of group that's growing in terms of political affiliation is the unaffiliated people who are kind of tired about partisan politics, but they're not really yet making much of a stance. So, yeah, I think I don't see any reason that any of this would change in the short to near term.
And it seems like this partisanship is playing over into the third branch of government, especially the judiciary. Back in March, the legislature overrode Governor Cooper's veto to make Superior Court and District Court elections back to partisanship. So we now have all judicial officers elected based on a partisan identification. Colin, what kind of impact do you think that this is going to have? And did the Republicans do this in order to help their party in the third branch of government?
You know, I think they realize that they've had success with making other parts of the judiciary partisan. This past year was the first year that the North Carolina Court of Appeals was a partisan election. Republicans managed to sweep that contest with having their labels on the ballot. So I think they're next going down to the sort of the last layer of government that is not partisan, although they did avoid some proposals to make municipal and school board races more partisan this year. They did do this with the Superior and District Court. And I think most people might say, well, you know, district courts handling traffic tickets and minor crimes, does it really matter if the person sitting on the bench is partisan or not? But the way that lawsuits work when the legislature's laws are challenged in court is that one of the first places they end up at is a Superior Court judge and these three-judge panels of members of the Superior Court that are handling these. So certainly if you can get more Republicans on the bench in that level across the state, you're perhaps going to have a more favorable audience when there's a lawsuit challenging something that the legislature did. So I think that's what they're aiming for here. But there may be unintended consequences that they're now trying to deal with, and that's that if you look at some of the urban counties like Wake and Mecklenburg, judges who happen to be Republican but have been running as nonpartisan may have a harder time winning in a county that leans to Democrats. And that was something that Democrats brought up, is that you might be shooting your own party in the foot. And legislators in the Republican side have responded to that with this proposal to redraw judicial districts for district and Superior Court, which is still pending, something we could see more of in the short sessions, but that would essentially draw particularly the large counties in a way that you would see more Republican judges coming out of Wake and Mecklenburg than if the judges were being elected countywide.
And that potentially, that bill hasn't been passed yet, but that is something that could be considered in the special session coming up?
Yeah, it's specifically listed as something that could come up, I believe, in the September session, looking at judicial redistricting sorts of issues, and that's something where, you know, they had the bill in the House the very last week of session, sort of came out as a surprise to a lot of people, didn't end up bringing it up for a vote, perhaps in the face of some of that backlash, but I think you could definitely see that coming up in the future, particularly if they're having to redraw the legislative lines anyway. They can perhaps tack this onto that and push it through in that manner.
Okay. I'll throw this open to anybody. Maybe, Tom, you might start us off with this conversation. After the previous voter ID law was struck down by a lower court's ruling and the Supreme Court declined to take it up, there was speculation that perhaps a new voter ID law might be written by this General Assembly. Have we heard anything about that? And is that a potential topic for the fall session in consideration of all this redistricting that's going on? They might throw in election reforms in that context?
To answer the first part of your question, I was actually pretty surprised by it. You heard a lot of Republicans say, why don't we just do a clean voter ID bill, get this on the books? You had former Governor Pat McCrory is a good example of that. I was relatively surprised that it never came to fruition. To the second part, could this be brought up in special session? It certainly could. We know of at least two special sessions that will happen, August and September, the two that we've been talking about. There's a possibility of a third in November. Mm-hmm. And there's always a possibility they just say, hey, let's do it anyway or amend one of these meetings. So it's still an idea that's out there in terms of on the ground, how much support is there or how far has this gone. I think Tim or Colin would probably be able to answer that better than I.
Yeah,
Tim?
Dr. Bitzer, yeah. I talked to a speaker more about this probably 2-3 weeks ago, and he basically said, yes, a voter ID bill will be coming. He didn't know whether it would be this session or perhaps, you know, next spring when they come back. At that time, we didn't know exactly if there were going to be two special sessions. He also made mention that the voter ID that will come, he would prefer in its own separate bill. Although that's just him speaking, because, you know, the last one came and I think it was a 48-page bill with many other things in it. Mm-hmm. And he also talked about it mirroring a voter ID law that has passed muster at the Supreme Court already. Some people have mentioned Georgia, although I've been hearing recently there may be some problems with that in relation to some of our other court challenges. And there has been some rumblings as well about, you know, they're talking about doing constitutional amendments in the special sessions as well. And could a voter ID part of something with something of that as well? So I think it is indeed coming. It's just a matter of when and what form it exactly looks like.
Colin, what would be some of the components of a voter ID law that potentially could pass judicial oversight and rulings?
You know, I think in the past, voter ID law, they had problems because they added so many other changes to the election system on there, the changes to the early voting schedule. I mean, a lot of things that the court could look at and say this seems to be targeting racial minorities in a way that, you know, the elimination of Sunday voting, for example, and that, I think, caught the court's attention and resulted in the law being completely thrown out. So I think what I'm hearing from Republicans is they want to do a very clean law. So it's simply just...
We'll pick up after the break with that conversation. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. And Doctors Making House Calls, physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at DoctorsMakingHouseCalls.com. Coming up next Tuesday, July 11th, WFAE and Charlotte Talks will host a public conversation about Charlotte's increasing homicides and the impact on the Queen City. The discussion will be at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church and will host the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief, Kerr Putney, and others while we discuss the homicide problem in Charlotte. Join us for the conversation next Tuesday in person or live at 7 p.m. on WFAE. You can find out more information at WFAE.org in the events section.
You catch glimpses of the news all day long. A quick glance at your phone, an overheard headline. The stories come in bits and pieces, and keeping up with it all can be exhausting. Now, to really catch up, listen to All Things Considered for more than the who, what, and where. We'll unpack the why and explain what it could mean for you tomorrow. stand with the facts. Listen to All Things Considered every day.
On air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And unfortunately, we had to cut Colin Campbell off quick due to the break. But go ahead and finish what you were talking about, the various components of what might be in a voter ID law. Do you want to pick up on that thread there?
Yeah. So as we went to the break, I was explaining that, you know, the voter ID law that was struck down in court had so many other components related to how elections function in North Carolina. And what I'm hearing from Republicans is they want to pass a clean bill to avoid sort of legal challenges. So I think they're going to look to match other states where a voter ID component has already passed legal muster and it is, you know, in good shape. So I would expect you might see just a very simple, you have to bring a photo ID to the polls. Perhaps there's a waiver option, as you saw under the previous voter ID law here, where you could fill out a form explaining why you were unable to obtain a photo ID. But other than that, I don't know that they'll tack a whole lot else onto this bill, just worrying that if they do, then they're more likely to have a court strike it down or end up in legal limbo for months or years at a time.
And I think, Tom, you had mentioned that this might be a constitutional amendment, that there could be a way to try and put this into the Constitution. Several other amendments have been proposed and may be dealt with in the fall special sessions. One of them may be capping the individual income tax rate at 5.5%. Another could establish a state constitutional right to hunt and also limit the government's power to take private land through eminent domain. Could we see these or other amendments appear before the voters anytime soon?
Sure, you could. And in fairness, it was Tim that actually brought this
up.
But yeah, we could see any or all of those things, because constitutional amendments are, again, on the slate for the special sessions. And it's interesting because a lot of these constitute, in fact, almost all of them. The eminent domain one is slightly different, but the others are simply there to codify what is current policy or law. Capping the income tax, that's basically a hedge by the Republican-controlled legislature to make sure that if Democrats take over the state House and Senate, they wouldn't be able to, you know, go past a certain threshold. That's certainly the way the Republicans will pitch it. The right to hunt and harvest wildlife is the terminology in that particular one. You know, that is kind of a regular thing that we see from lawmakers, specifically in rural areas. And this year, it was rolled out on the same day that it was, you know, the NRA was at the General Assembly, the Sporting Rights Association, all of the usual gun rights groups were there. So it's a lot of it is for show, but yes, we could certainly see voter ID added in as well.
Okay. Much has been made about the relationship, not just between the state government branches, the governor and the legislature, but also between the state and local governments. Over the past couple of sessions, we've seen attempts at the Charlotte Airport, the Asheville Water System, redistricting in Greensboro and Wake County. Tim, how did local governments fare this year under the Republicans at the legislature?
Well, some might argue they fared better in the past because we weren't discussing, you know, huge redistribution of sales tax and other items as well. You know, one of the larger topics I think keeps coming up, and I've heard this, I mean, since even when Democrats were in charge, but, you know, local municipalities and counties' role in funding of education and transportation as well. You know, there was an interesting bond that was proposed and discussed about putting school construction up I thought that was a really interesting sort of discussion point because, you know, counties usually are responsible for it, and it could open a Pandora's box of sorts for saying, hey, the state's paying for all this school construction, you know, they should keep paying for more. But, you know, Colin may have, you know, more details on some very specific bills, but I didn't hear a massive outcry like I have in prior years about certain issues, in particular things like a sales tax redistribution.
Colin?
And there was some discussion about a sales tax shift. Senator Majority Leader Harry Brown from Jacksonville, who's been pushing this for several sessions, had a bill that would tweak the formula a little bit in terms of how much sales tax revenue each county gets, and it would have penalized the urban counties a bit. That bill did not get a hearing in the House, so that did not go forward. On the other hand, cities and counties didn't necessarily get what they wanted. The school construction bond that Tim mentioned still, I think, is awaiting a Senate hearing on that issue. There's also a proposal to create a municipal-only sales tax that would allow cities and towns to raise money for infrastructure, economic development projects. That's something that did not make its way to law this session, but of course those issues could be revisited in any of the short sessions coming up.
Well, both of you had mentioned the potential $1.5 billion bond for school construction that's still being considered. Estimated needs put the total figure across the state at $8 billion, and part of the package would require a match from larger, more urban counties to the money that they receive, but that smaller, lower, wealthier counties would not have to match it. Tom, is this part of the dynamics of what we talk about, the urban-rural divide? Could this be another sign of making urban areas pay for their share, but rural areas would get the money from the state?
Sounds like you're talking a little bit of wealth redistribution there.
Well,
you dancer, yes. But honestly, you know, sure, this could obviously be that. There is also another argument that's based on just sheer economics, which is richer urban counties can't afford to pay more. You know, there are some of – out of the 100 counties in North Carolina, you can point to a few that are relatively wealthy. Without a doubt, Wake, you know, Mecklenburg obviously.
Sure.
And you can find a whole bunch that are very, very – they're just getting by. So I think you could argue that this is, in fact, a fair way to – if the state is going to pony up some extra cash to help with school construction, this is a fair way to do it. I mean, here in Mecklenburg County, we also are going to have a nearly billion-dollar school bond referendum coming up in November. So, you know, Mecklenburg can raise that kind of money. The poorer counties out east and out west, it would be nary impossible for them to be able to do that. So you could also just see it as fair economics.
Okay.
I forget that this is an argument, you know, that is political as well, because we have leadership and budget writers that are still from rural parts of the state. And we have Democrats and rural or urban lawmakers trying to make sure that they keep their money as well. So it's as much of a political dynamic as it is rural and urban economics.
Okay. There was some action taken that tended to gain overwhelming support in the House regarding environmental issues. And this had to deal with solar and biomass electricity, and in particularly the impact that Duke Energy was going to have on this. But there was also, in the Senate, a moratorium on wind energy projects put into the bill. Colin, can you talk about that particular piece of legislation that was passed?
Yeah, so this was something that the Senate has been pushing for a couple years now. They're very concerned that some of the big wind tower projects that are slated for the northeastern corner of the state might have some negative impact to military flight paths. Some of the studies differ on whether there's any truth to that, and certainly the military has not been lobbying very heavily on this topic. But it's something where the Senate had proposed a four-year moratorium on wind energy development, and that was tacked onto this otherwise non-controversial House renewable energy bill that was really all about stimulating development of solar energy, allowing people to have more opportunities to have home solar installations. It was a sort of a big, broad support bill, had the utilities behind it, had a lot of the environmentalists behind it. But then the Senate goes and adds this moratorium, which would essentially have killed several of these big wind energy projects up in the northeastern corner of the state. That ended up being a bone of contention until the very final hour of the legislative session at 1 a.m. The House and Senate finally reached a deal on this bill, dropped that moratorium down to an 18-month moratorium, which still was making a lot of people unhappy, but certainly a lot lower than the 4 years initially envisioned, and then all the solar renewable energy provisions that everyone could agree to was able to pass that. That bill is sitting on Governor Cooper's desk, and it'll be interesting to see if he vetoes that as a result of the wind moratorium.
Well, let's talk about the governor's vetoes. I believe he has issued 5 vetoes in just this past 6 months. Every one of them has been overridden by the legislature,
and
very quickly. Does that speak to and again, this we talked about the relationship between the two branches. Tom, does this speak to the governor's power and his lack thereof, or his willingness to say, I am going to stand up to the legislature, even though the supermajorities in the legislature are going to override my veto?
I would say both. I mean, in simple terms, the state legislature, the General Assembly, is clearly the most powerful branch of government right now in the state, period. I mean, they've been able to cap and move and shift power back centered on them without a doubt. You know, I think Governor Cooper has picked his veto as well. There are some bills that he could have easily just – it could have been a veto factory in essence. His desk and the big red stamp could have been used ad nauseum. There are plenty more than five bills that could have been vetoed. So I think he was smart in picking his targets. And the General Assembly was quick to, you know, just override every single one of them. I think proof in terms of the political dynamic and how the Democrats might play this is coming from Darren Jackson, House Minority Leader, who is, you know, has said specifically when it came to the budget that, you know, we don't have power now. We cannot break the supermajority. But guess what? Elections are on the way. And clearly the Democrats are looking at these vetoes that were overridden as a easy way for them, potentially in new legislative districts, to campaign and try to take back the seats to break that supermajority. And the number isn't huge. I think it's, what, two or three seats in the House is all it would take to break that supermajority, which would effectively end the supermajorities because you need both chambers to override. So I think it's a long game, but it does also show that right now the governor does not have an enormous amount of power.
Tim, do you see that in playing out in the state capitol?
Yeah, I mean, look, that was the other part of the strategy that we were interested in seeing when we entered the session, because it was talked about when Pat McCrory was governor, would he veto? And if he did, would it make him look weak? You know, in a lot of ways, the governor's not in a win-win situation here. And so he might as well look like he's standing up to the legislature, because everybody knows they're going to override him because they have complete power. So I agree with Tom. I think he's picking and choosing not to make it look like he's just willy-nilly vetoing everything he doesn't like. He has lost. He's, you know, the legislature's 5-5 on overriding. I think he has vetoed a sixth one, that garbage juice bill, as it was called, yep. One of my favorite titles. you know, who knows if that will get overridden. I wouldn't be surprised. But, yeah, I mean, this is not the last veto we'll see. You know, I don't think it's a big sticking point for them politically for either side, because I think it's probably at the end of the day what most of us would have expected.
Well, let's talk about the garbage juice, since we've piqued our listeners' ears on that. Colin, what was the garbage juice bill?
So this was an environmental bill regarding how you deal with certain types of landfill waste, particularly the liquid that comes off of landfills. And the technical scientific term for this process is aerosolization of leachate, but has been described by opponents as garbage juice in a snowblower. So the concern from folks opposing this bill is that you're going to have some major impacts on air quality around landfill facilities if you're essentially, you know, taking this garbage juice and putting it in sort of a large aerosol can and spraying it out into the air. The folks supporting it say it's perfectly safe and won't have any negative impacts on air quality, but certainly has made for an interesting and eye-catching debate with some of these terms, and was one of the first bills out of this hectic last week of session that got a veto from Governor Cooper. So on Friday, right before the holiday weekend, he signed the brunch bill and vetoed the garbage juice bill and put out a single press release announcing both actions.
Well, that was going to be my segue from one liquid form to another, the brunch bill. What was that, Tom? What was all about the brunch bill?
The brunch bill is just basically loosening some of the blue laws in North Carolina, allowing restaurants to start selling alcoholic drinks on Sunday before noon, hence the brunch and the brunch bill title. But there's you know, what this law did, you can't just run out now and assume that you're going to get your mimosa as early as you like. It actually establishes a path for municipalities and counties to decide whether or not they're going to, you know, pass their own ordinances that allow this.
So county governments, local governments have to pass a follow-up piece of ordinances, legislation to allow this. It was just lifting the opportunity by the state.
Correct.
To do so.
Yep.
Okay. All right. And along with getting your mimosas on Sunday mornings, apparently now you can also go hunting on Sunday morning, which had been previously banned from 9:30 in the morning to 12:30 p.m. Colin, what was the impetus behind having Sunday morning mimosas and then going out and shooting a deer?
Hopefully not at the same time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That opportunity is there.
Discussion of the idea of, you know, drinking on Sunday mornings while hunting, that bill got very much watered down by the end. So I think the final version actually still prevents you from going hunting on Sundays between 9:30 and 12:30. It does, I think, open up different types of hunting, assuming the wildlife regulators agree to it on Sundays. The idea behind that being that, you know, if you have more opportunities to hunt on weekends, more young people will get involved and perhaps put away the video games and get more active in outdoor sports like hunting. So that was sort of the rationale behind that. But that had a lot of opposition from church groups that were concerned that people would be shooting off guns right outside of the sanctuary or skipping church to go drink a mimosa and then go hunting. And so a lot of the more exciting provisions of that bill got stripped out right towards the end.
And it seemed like in the rush to the end of the legislature's session, at least this part of it last week, there was a resolution that passed the state Senate to call a federal constitutional convention. But the resolution was at first defeated in the state House, only to be resurrected on a second vote and sent off to committee. Tim, what's the point of this resolution? Is it still alive to be voted on in the fall sessions?
Well, as I like to tell people, when there's a will, there's a way. So even if it was voted down and done forever, I would be convinced that it could come back. This has been an issue that has been, you know, argued on for some time across the country. Several other states have passed these as well. They believe that, I think the speaker may, and Colin may know more about this, but there was arguments that, you know, spending's out of control. And so they want to move forward with this. I don't know what North Carolina is going to do, but I think it's about a dozen other states that have already done this.
And that's Tim Boyum from Spectrum News, joining Colin Campbell from the Raleigh News and Observer and Tom Bullock from WFAA News. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.